Session number 6229, reel 6.
Mrs. Colley, reel 6. How frequently would you get some protein by way of meat or fish included in the rations?
Well, if we were lucky, we got a little every day. But of course, a little meant really a little that you couldn't recognise. Mostly, it was, as I say, stewed, and you might get one or two fragments. But the stew was the thing. The soup that we could make from it with the vegetables was the thing. And the meat, the actual meat content was very, very small indeed, perhaps a few cubes, very small cubes that you might find if you were lucky. And sometimes, at times, it was so fluid, it's very difficult to say one way or the other, because sometimes we'd get it every day. And then we could go for a long time and get none. It was very hit or miss. I suppose it was whatever they happened to have. But we did, the protein was the thing that we were very short of. And, of course, the vegetables, the mineral content of vegetables, we missed terribly. We tried cooking everything possible. We stretching our hands through the barbed wire, trying to pick things through the barbed wire to add to our diet. You know, I'm sure we took terrible chances. And we even ate the skin of bananas and tapioca root. Well, now, tapioca root skin, I've read recently, actually, funnily enough, that it's quite poisonous. But we soaked it and boiled it. And anything, you know, was grist to our mill. You felt that if it was vaguely edible, that you should eat it. Chopped up banana skins and boiled those and ate them and pounded the fish bones. When we had fish, we used to never throw anything away. We'd pound the fish bones and make them into some sort of a paste. We did sometimes get oil, coconut oil sometimes, red palm oil sometimes, and bean shoots sometimes. Now, bean shoots were quite good. You know, nowadays, of course, you can buy bean shoots, but they were very good. And then, of course, they started sending us in soya beans. And, of course, there's a lot of protein in soya beans. And we didn't like them because we didn't realise how good they were supposed to be for us. But they were terrible things. Again, they were like the maize. They were so old. They were the old, hard variety. And we used to soak them and try to pound them. And we found them very difficult to turn into edible matter. And, however, they do contain protein, and so sometimes we got those, and they knew that. They did try to send in those when they could, but we didn't appreciate it very much because they were terribly difficult to eat. Mm. And that's about all. That was about the only things, apart from the things we could buy when we could buy.
Well, I was going to ask you whether, apart from the official rations you got from the Japanese, there were any other sources of food.
Well, when we were in the houses, the second lot of houses, they did allow this man to come up once a week with things that we had to buy ourselves from our own money. And then we could get, depended what he brought. He just bought anything he could. We didn't always get the same. We could buy coconuts, which were, of course, a great boon if we could get a coconut. Peanut brittle sometimes he bought. A stuff called Gula Malacca, which is sweet cakes of sweet stuff. It's like compounded very dark brown sugar into cakes, and sometimes we could buy that. Limes, which, of course, now they were a great asset. We did know that we should have those, so we bought limes when we could, bananas, which were filling, and just things that was about all, local produce.
You wouldn't care to try your hand at spelling Gula Malacca, would you?
Yes, it's just G-U-L-A. And Malacca, just like Malacca, M-A-L-A-C-C-A.
Oh, thank you. Any other sources of food? Did anyone start any vegetable gardens?
Oh, well, we did. That was when we got into the hutments. We didn't, in the houses, we didn't. But when we got into the hutments, Now you asked if the Japs made us do anything. Now they did make us do that, because obviously they were getting very short of the source of supply or something. And the quadrangle, because there where we were in the hutments, the huts were round a quadrangle, and it was hard-packed, trodden earth. And they made us dig this up to plant. And it was very, very difficult. It was iron hard, and they brought in an implement which was called a chunkle, which was like a hoe set at right angles to the handle, and that you wheeled by moving over your shoulder and down in front of you. And we had to chunkle the ground up, this hard ground, and they brought us in sweet potatoes to plant and tapioca. And the idea was that this would help to provide us with food. But it really didn't work, because as soon as the sweet potatoes had grown, and of course this meant another problem, because we had to water this, and water was very scarce, and we'd got to walk about half a mile downhill and a half a mile uphill in that camp with water, which had to go on the gardens and had to be for the kitchen to cook and so on. And it came to fruition, when it grew and when the potatoes would have been nearly big enough to dig up and so on, we were moved. So although we'd done this, we never really benefited by it. But that was the only time that we did any planting ourselves.
When you say the Japs made you do this, was this because they wanted a share of the produce for themselves, or was
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know at all. I think perhaps they were a bit short of food then. Yes.
And the only source of food which you could purchase was in this travelling shop.
Yes.
What was it? A man with a cart, or what?
Yes, that's all. Mm. Yes, he just used to come up with a cart and. Again, it was unpredictable, the sort of thing he would bring. Some weeks he brought one thing, some another. We used to beg him to always bring limes and bananas and coconuts, but he didn't always. Obviously, I don't know, I suppose perhaps he couldn't get it locally. I don't know what the idea was, but he didn't always bring the things that we wanted.
Here at Pelham Bang, did you ever receive any parcels from home or from the Red Cross?
Obviously parcels, Red Cross parcels did come, because we saw the Japs smoking Chesterfield cigarettes and American cigarettes, which they couldn't have obtained except from our parcels. And once they brought us in a basin full of pâté de foie gras in a wash basin, which of course must have come from tins that they'd opened, but obviously they didn't like this, or they couldn't understand this at all, so they thought they'd let us have that. And they tipped the contents, I suppose, of goodness knows how many tins, although who would have sent pâté de foie gras in tins from Red Cross parcels, I don't know. And they brought in this great basin of pâté de foie gras, which was a bit difficult to tip out, but ration out, but in reality I think we had about a teaspoonful each or something. And but apart from that, we were just moving from that camp, and about a night or two before we moved, I suppose they must have had these parcels in store for so long, and they thought, well, before we went, that we'd better have these. They opened them. They opened them themselves. We never saw it. Well, we did see them opening them, but we never had a chance. And they brought in what had been in Red Cross parcels, and they brought in corned beef, tins of fish, salmon, I think, and chocolate and cheese, dried prunes, cigarettes, and one or two things like that. But when it was opened up, this is what we got from the only Red Cross parcel we had: 22 cigarettes, mouldy, one good prune and five bad ones, a piece of chocolate about 1 1/4 by 1/2 inch, and that was mouldy, three tiny cubes of sugar, a thin slice of Kraft cheese, and a cube of cheese that was mouldy. One cube was quite bad. A packet of soup powder, milk powder, to be divided among 10 people, which was about, it was about a 2-pound tin of milk powder, but that was for 10 people. A cake of soap among 6 of us. I don't know how you cut up a piece of soap for 6 people. A tin of butter for 4 of us. And that was not until October 44, and that was all that we saw of the contents of any Red Cross parcel.
Can I take you back to, I mean, the bulk of the food you got came by way of official rations from the Japanese. Mm. Now, at Pelembang, when the rations came, whether on a daily or a two-daily basis, how were they actually divided and allocated? Was it on a house-by-house basis or what?
Yes, well, I did say earlier, you know, I had gone into this, I said how it was difficult because there were different numbers in every house. And that although we could do the rice, we had to do the other as best we could. Because the houses, unfortunately, hadn't got the same number in them. But the rice was easy enough to divide out. And the rest was just divided out as fairly as we possibly could according to the number of people who were in each house. Mm.
How did you do the cooking in the houses?
Well, these fires, wood fires that we made, built ourselves at the back of the houses.
And so you were cooking individually or for the house?
Well, we cooked for the whole 15 of us, but some of them broke off even in their own houses and cooked for 2 or 3 of them. They gradually separated out, and some of them were even, one woman was even cooking for herself. But as a party, we cook for the whole 15 of us all the time.
Did the system change when you moved to the Attap huts?
Yes, it had to change. We started off cooking in small numbers, but I think it was because of the risk of fire. These huts were Attap huts and could have easily been caught fire.
Explain what an Attap hut was.
Oh, palm-leaved roofs to them, just dried palm leaves overlaying each other for the roofs, which, of course, would go up in flames the slightest hint of a spark. And the huts themselves were just built of wood poles and more Attap at the sides. They were purely Attap huts. And the men had built them, actually. Our English men had to build those for themselves. And we went into them after the men. The men were moved out. And we went into the huts that they had built. And they were purely wood and Attap. And it was very, very inflammable. And people started making little fires all over the place. And quite rightly, the Japs stopped it because of the risk of fire and said that we must cook communally. And they built a shelter in the middle of this sort of parade ground, this rectangle. And they brought in huge cauldrons that would hold about 100 weight of rice at a time and set them up. And we had 2 kitchens going, one for the Dutch and one for the British. And we then had to do the cooking for the whole of the community in that central kitchen. All the individual cooking was cut out.
Did the communal cooking tend to produce better or worse results?
Well, no, worse, because, of course, as communal cooking always is, for one thing, the rice wasn't individually picked over as it had been when we were in the houses. We took care that the rice we cooked had all been thoroughly picked over, but it was impossible to pick over as much rice as they needed for communal cooking. And the vegetables weren't so well prepared, although there was a squad, of course, that we had to have squads of people preparing the vegetables and so on. But they, in such large quantities, they couldn't be prepared in the same way that we had prepared them when we were cooking for smaller numbers. And there was less imagination used. It was just a question of getting all this stuff cooked for so many people so that it was much less imaginative. We got quite good at and imaginative with our cooking. Even with the little we had, we'd managed to do all sorts of things with it.
Like
we
what,
were cooking
for
a small quantity. Well, our cook had even managed to produce some sort of a pudding by pounding the rice down or grinding it down into flour and steaming it in a tin and putting something with it when we managed to buy some sugary stuff and put that in it, and we imagined that we'd got a pudding. Well, nothing like that could be done for a communal cooking. And curries and things like that were made individually. Very difficult to produce that on a large scale. So that, you know, the whole thing was much more deadly monotonous once we got down to communal cooking.
Now, we've talked quite a lot about the food, and you've pointed out some of the grave deficiencies which existed by way of lack of vegetables, lack of protein and so on. Did this have any deleterious effect on the health of internees?
Well, yes, because we got what was virtually, I suppose, akin to scurvy in a way. We had terrible rashes came out, and we were scratching all the time. It was itch, and I think that was largely due to the our diet deficiencies, although I believe, of course, it can be caused by some, probably from the hutments that were dirty. Then, of course, everybody was getting terribly thin, and a lot of people were getting beriberi, because on a rice diet, this is the thing that does happen, which is consists of swollen stomachs. You know, they get distended out of all proportion, and even you get edema in the legs, and very bad cases, they would be so swollen that their legs became stiff, just like logs of wood, and they were unable to bend their legs. And if it got very bad, the skin could even burst, because the fluid in the limbs would get so severe that they would the skin could actually burst. And this is purely because they were on a rice diet and not enough protein. Hair began to fall out, of course, and I suppose in practically everywhere. I got a tropical ulcer, which wasn't the only one in the camp, but because of the lack of fat in the diet, this wouldn't heal. And it really was eating right down to the bone. And the doctor, we got very worried. I had to rest. She said I mustn't do anything, because she said you'll end by having your leg off if that gets any worse. But fortunately for me, just at the critical moment, they sent some red palm oil into the camp, which was for us to eat, of course, to put in with our food. That was very good for us. And the doctor took some of that for medical purposes, and they put masses of palm oil on my ulcer, and gradually sort of feeding the flesh, as it were. And gradually the ulcer began to heal up. It gradually got smaller and smaller, and I had that to thank for that. So these were all things with the diet deficiencies. But beriberi, I suppose, was the worst hazard, because, of course, when they got very bad, people just died of it. And some people died of malnutrition, of course. A lot of them died of malnutrition.
Can you give me any indication of the incidence of death amongst internees at Pelembang?
Well, we reckon by the time we came out that a third of the British women and children had died. I don't know what the percentage was among the Dutch, but a third of our people had died by the time we came out.
What, if any, kind of medical facilities were available to you?
Well, very, very few, very little, very limited indeed. The trouble was that, you see, they didn't give us any drugs when we were in the houses. As I said, the very bad cases could go down to the hospital in Pelembang. But when we moved to the Atap huts in Pelembang, we had to set up our own hospital ward. We took over one of the huts and called it the hospital. And that was purely for sick people, and they were taken in there. And by that time, we had four doctors in the camp. And so one doctor was in charge of the hospital wing, And the other doctors did the clinical work, seeing the camp generally. And people were taken into this hospital wing, which was all very well, but then there were so few things to give anybody. Now, I had jaundice myself, and I should have been put on a diet and so on. But you see, there was nothing else to offer me but the food of the camp. I could only have the food of the camp. There was nothing else there. And people who had malaria, well, there was no quinine tablets and so on. And so it was very, very difficult at times. I'm not saying exactly that there was never any. Sometimes we'd get some quinine tablets in. Sometimes the doctors would get some sort of medication, but not nearly enough, not enough to do really any serious, make any serious inroads into the illnesses. I mean, when we were in the hutments, there were 78 of us in this hut, and the doctor had one quinine tablet, and there were about 15 of us down with malaria. Now, one quinine tablet for 15 people. So she decided to give it to the person with the highest temperature. Well, I was lucky, I suppose. Mine was the highest, so I got the quinine tablet. And my temperature had to be 106 to get the quinine tablet, which would have killed anybody normally. But she said, when she gave it to me, she said, oh, I don't mind giving it to you because you can swallow them. She said, I gave it to somebody the other day and they brought it up straight away. Waste of a tablet. And she was so upset. Well, I can understand. If you've only got one tablet for 15 people, it's jolly hard to see somebody immediately spit it out, isn't it? So, and this is the sort of thing that went on, you know. We just didn't, I mean, I had malaria over and over and over again. And, of course, it was ridiculous. If we'd had the proper medicines, we should have been cured. We should have all been on tablets for malaria, of course. The whole camp should have been being dosed with malarial tablets.
What was the attitude of the Japanese to the very poor health conditions and the incidence of death?
Well, sometimes we'd get visitors, and they sometimes seemed quite sympathetic. Once or twice, a whole lot of people would come round. Once they came round with nurses with Red Cross armbands on, and they walked around the camp. But you see, nothing resulted from. They shake their heads and they said to us, "Where are the beds?" And we laughed. You know, "Where are your beds? Where are your beds?" We pointed to the floor. "Where were our beds?" They wanted to know. "Where were the mosquito nets?" Well, we said, "Yes, where are the mosquito nets?" Shook their heads very sorrowfully. Oh dear, you know. And one guard, you know, said, oh, they were very sorry for us. But, you see, nothing got done. Nothing ever was done for us. Despite them, their being sorry didn't help us very much. Just some of them were quite sympathetic. Because, see, the Japs, it was rather strange, because when the war broke out, all the Japanese everywhere in the world who could get back were recalled. Well, some of them had been in America, for instance, all their lives in America. They were recalled, and there they were. They were used to an American way of life and living among Europeans, and there they were suddenly recalled to fight for their country against Europeans with whom they'd had such a good rapport and lived for years. So there were some who were Europeanized, despite their uniform and despite their appearance. They were completely Europeanized Japanese.
You've already said something about the subject of clothing, and I imagine that the standards of clothing must have varied enormously amongst the internees.
Well, it did, because, you see, some people had managed to take luggage in, some people had managed to take quite a bit of luggage in, and then there were these people who'd come out of the sea, who'd been shipwrecked, who had nothing but what they actually stood up in. And so there was a very great variation. Some people had given to them, of course, and as your clothes drop to pieces, and in a climate like that, perspiration will rot your clothing, if nothing else. This sun, the heat of the sun and perspiration, nothing, not even the strongest cotton will last for very long. And so people were literally in shreds because the sun and perspiration were simply rotting their clothes.
Yes. What were the worst problems by way of clothing?
Well, just that, as I say, we cut down what we'd got so that we could make shorts and sun tops, practically the whole top was wearing sun top. The whole camp was wearing sun tops, which takes the minimum of material. And in that way, if you had to cut up your dress, for instance, you could perhaps make half a dozen sun tops out of what you'd done, what had been a dress. Well, then that would last you quite a while, as long as you'd got some shorts to go with it. But the shorts were the problem because we needed such strong material for our shorts.
What was the design of your sun top?
Oh, just a halter round the neck,
yeah.
Veritably a triangle, turned over at one corner, a halter round the neck and tied at the back. That was all.
So a bare midriff, would it be? Would your midriff be bare?
Yes, oh yes.
Yeah.
Yes, oh yes, and our back's completely bare. You see, bare, yes. Bare from the shoulders down to the waist. And just this, well, a glorified bra, a sort of top of a, just like the top of a bathing suit might be.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately for us, of course, we did have a good climate. It was a hot climate. I know that because it was hot, we probably got more diseases, more infectious diseases and so on, you see. But on the other hand, with the few clothes we had, we were lucky that it wasn't cold.
Mm.
Don't know how we would have coped. Of course, we had to abandon things to sleep in. Most of us, even if those of us had gone in with a nightdress, that was long since cut up to make a mosquito net or something like that, because the mosquito net was the thing that, you know, we needed most of all.
Was there any sources of new clothing available to you?
No, apart from this yard and a half of oil the Japs gave us, and what we could buy when we were in the houses. When this man came round, we could get material for him if we got any money. So at that time, we could buy a little from him if we had the money.
Mm-hmm. And repair of maintenance of clothing, that was an individual thing.
Oh, yes. Well, we were forever lastingly. I mean, after the first year, I suppose, we were always darning and mending. And at first, we were able to buy cotton from this man. But afterwards, we just have to shred out the material that we had and use the threads to darn with and sew with, just the threads from the material. And shoes, of course, were a great problem. Terrible problem, because of course I'd had a spare pair of shoes and I was wearing a pair of shoes, but they soon went down, the heels went down. I was wearing them down on one side. I managed to wrench off the layers and stick them back, nail them back the opposite way around for a bit. Then I took to wearing them on the wrong feet to try and wear them out as a different part. But that didn't work. That made my legs ache, I must confess. And then eventually we gave up altogether and we just wore trompers, the Chinese clogs, which we could buy from the man. Sometimes he brought up rubber-soled ones, which were like the thong things that you see now in the shops. And the trompers were wooden soles with just a band of old tyre rubber across the toes to keep them on. And they saved our lives, our feet, by, I think, everybody in the camp practically was going about in these wooden trompers, because they were fairly hard wearing. The wood lasted quite a while.
Yes. You've talked about purchasing things from your travelling shop. What kind of currency were you using for these transactions?
Well, it had to be Dutch guilders for the shop, as far as the shopman was concerned. But eventually the Japs produced their own guilders, printed their own currency, and this was equivalent in value to the Dutch guilders, but of course it was completely worthless if you were left with any after the war, and unfortunately some people were left with it after the war, but it was completely useless then. It was just currency that the Japanese had printed. It was just printed money and had no value whatever, really. I suppose the man who owned the shop was able to exchange it, because I suppose all the probably all Palembang then was using Dutch money, Japanese money, and it was authorized currency for the time of the occupation, I assume. But of course they, like us, if they were left with it, of course would find that it was worthless, whatever they had left.
Yes. Were there any apart from the money you brought in to internment camps with you, were there any other sources of money available to you?
No, after, I can't think, I think it was in 44, sometime in 44, suddenly the Japs said they were going to pay us. And, of course, now I realise that they were supposed to, there's supposed to be money available for internees, because the men in the men's camps, as far as the military went, they were supposed, there's a lot of controversy about it at the moment, and they were given a certain amount of money by whoever was had them in prison, or their captors were. And so I take it that suddenly, in about 1944, sometime, the Japs who were in Sumatra must have been told that they had to give us a certain amount of money. Whether as civilians we were eligible or not, I don't know, but we were suddenly given this money, which was only about $4.50, and I can't remember, I think it was a month, but at least it was just something that used to come in after that. Until the end, that came in fairly regularly, this small amount that we were doled out with every month, in their current, in Japanese money, of course.
Was there much commerce going on in the camp on a sort of barter basis?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. We lived by barter towards the end. We were, that was our only thing that we did. For instance, sometimes there would be, for instance, chilies. For instance, came in. Well, now I don't like chilies, but I was craving for salt because I can't eat. Well, I found rice.